Hello, hello, and welcome back or welcome to the Life Without Limits podcast. It's season three. I'm your host, Yogi Roth, and I am fired up about season three because the first conversation we had, I keep hearing about, and it was with Jared Blank. If you haven't heard it, try to go back if you have time and listen to it because it will impact you. Jared Blank is on the verge of running seven marathons on seven continents in 7 days. That's right, 777. It's called the World Marathon Challenge. And of course, that is ridiculously impressive, insane, mind-blowing, but his path will impact you probably even more. At 5 years old, he was told he would not graduate high school as he dealt with dyslexia. Not only did he deal with it, but he thrived. Two master's degrees later, two national championships in major college football, oversaw over 100 players who got drafted, as Jared worked for both USC and the University of Washington as the director of football operations, a very coveted job in administration and football. And he quit to go seek what he loved. The conversation today is about somebody who chased something that he loved. His name is Taylor Cavanaugh. You may know the name. Taylor was on this podcast before as a filmmaker, as a storyteller. He's got a production company titled Blue Ox Films. Brilliant. They do unique projects all around the world with brands like Nike. He did the Kevin Hart project. He's worked with the Pac-12 Network, as he directed and produced a documentary series titled The Drive, which I've been able to be a part of as a producer and a narrator. And then, of course, he's done his independent projects as well, scripted. He's worked with Amazon, done music videos with Kate Vogel, and he and I and his partner Matt Wilcox did a short this past off-season around Inauguration Day titled What Does It Mean to Be Human? As we interviewed people all over L.A. and asked them that simple question. He's worked on a variety of things. We've collaborated on a bunch. He's a guy I'm going to work with forever. So he's going to be on this podcast for as long as he'll be willing to come on it. But our conversation in this podcast episode, I think, is really unique because he is a former walk-on, much like myself. He also earned a scholarship like myself. And right now, it's bowl season. It's the holidays. It's about self-reflection. It's about what are our goals? What are our dreams? Are we going to go chase them? And I think in college football, as we watch all these big games around the country, we see the helmet, we see the logo, we see the brands, right? We're going to see the Trojans play Ohio State and the history around that. We're going to see Alabama and Clemson, third straight year. But we don't always see the kid behind the face mask. I learned that this past offseason as I did a podcast with Sam Darnold, that he's still a young man developing. Similar with Taylor Cavanaugh, even myself, when we were in college, we were still developing and we were chasing our dreams. So we decided to sit down and have a conversation about what it meant to be a walk-on. He did it at Oregon State. Nobody knew him. He literally walked up to the football office, banged down the door, and said, "Hi, I want to make the team." Not only did he make the team, but he ended up starting, and he earned a full athletic scholarship. And we talk about the journey. Our stories parallel a lot, as I was a former walk-on, earned a scholarship as well. And I think it's really fun to take you inside what it's like to go for something that you dream of. Because we all have that, right? And this season three is all about helping us go after what we seek. And whether that is the job or the partner or the opportunity or the audition, nobody's ever going to give us the keys. Nobody's ever going to say, "Hey, come just follow me and this is exactly where and how you get it done." No, you got to go after it. You got to dive in. You got to chase it. You know, Taylor says very eloquently, aggressive pursuit of excellence is never wasted, even if you do not achieve the intended goal, because we can always choose how we want to respond to that. He also talks about being a walk-on and chasing what you seek. He says, be so good that they can't ignore you. And he finishes this podcast with an incredible quote. And he borrows it from Viktor Frankl in the book Man's Search for Meaning. He says, the meaning of life is to help others find the meaning of theirs. And when we're seeking our dream, we don't necessarily think about that. So I wanted to take you inside the college football world as the college football season is coming to a close. We're in bowl season. I want you to dive in and listen to Taylor Cavanaugh, what it means to go and chase your dream, be a walk-on, and as he says, be so good they can't ignore you. Happy holidays. Enjoy this one. Oh, and we're live in the studio here in Venice Beach, California, Life Without Limits podcast. Fired up for this one because this is something that's close to athletes' hearts, but also I think anybody who's a fan of sport or a fan of an underdog, the ultimate underdog, Taylor Cavanaugh. Welcome back to the studio, man. Repeat offender.
So solid to be here, Yogue. As always, number two is going to be just number as good as number one.
I love it. All right, so the walk-ons. When you hear that phrase, what's one of the first thoughts that you have?
You know what I relate, you know, that very well-known term in sports? I relate it a little bit to survival, right? That's like the that's what we've been bred to do as humans, is to survive until, like, you know, 200 years ago when life became a little easier. That's what I relate it to.
Tell us your walk-on story. I talked about it in the open of, like, both of our paths as walk-ons. I've never had this conversation before, and we're going to kind of bounce it back and forth. But when did you even hear of the term walk-on, and how did it become even a reality for you?
You know, I think it was early in high school. And both of my parents, Dan and Jennifer, went to Oregon State. That's where they met. I grew up in Portland, grew up listening to Mike Parker on the radio, going down to Corvallis, living and breathing and sort of ingesting, you know, Oregon State. So I had this huge sort of vision in my mind of, you know, what college football was and how the epicenter in my world was Corvallis, Oregon. And I was a good high school athlete. Like, I worked harder than anybody else, you know, played both ways, did the whole thing, multiple sports. But I learned what the term walk-on was when I had a couple high school coaching advocates that I think saw something like a good coach does, sees something more in you than you see in yourself at the time. And, you know, I decided to go to Oregon State for academics, and, you know, sports, athletics was a secondary thing, but I wasn't going to do the secondary thing at a secondary rate.
When you were in high school or even growing up, was it like, I'm going to go play in Reser Stadium? You know, when did it become like a dream for you?
I think it always was, but...
Like, was it ever not going to happen, I guess maybe is the better question?
No, not really. It was going to happen. I think I've always been the athlete, the student, the person that was all in on what's right in front of me. And I think there may have been moments where that wasn't right in front of me going through high school. Maybe there were other things that came up, but the latter part of, you know, high school at Lincoln High in Portland, like, that became sort of, you know, I was going to Oregon State. I knew that. Check. I wanted to do engineering. It's a great engineering school. Check. Okay, what's the third checkbox? And that became front and center. And I had some really good advocates that kind of said, yeah, like, that's worthy. Get after it. Wow. And it just, it became that front and center thing. And, you know, it's a good story of, you know, just not taking no for an answer.
Yeah, no, we're going to get into that because you literally went through that. I'm fascinated with that story because you had a lot of support, it sounded like, to go walk on. Yeah. You know, for me, it was totally different. You know, I didn't know what sport I was going to play in college. You know, as a kid, we both grew up in really unique communities in Pennsylvania. You know, we didn't have a stoplight, 2,500 people. I mean, you just bawled every day, and your life was going to be sport. You know, at 7 and 8 years old, I was going to be Agassi. You know, at 12, I was going to be Barkley. You know, and at 14, I was like, okay, I'm going to be Jerry Rice. And it was just going to happen. And as the college's letters started coming in, I don't know how it was for you, but for me, I got all the letters. Didn't realize that everybody got all the letters. And the internet, you know, I'm, 4 or 5 years older than you. Internet wasn't there yet. Mm-hmm. So you kind of tried to subscribe to a recruiting service. You wanted something. You didn't know. And I always empathize with the high school kids and the parents. They're like, what do we do? Because I had no clue. My parents weren't, you know, we didn't have a ton of cash. We didn't have, you know, an alumni database. Nobody played sports. Pennsylvania, you know, people call it a recruiting hotbed, but that's because, like, it was the Montana era and Jim Kelly. Like, it really wasn't anymore. So it was hard. And then I went to a game for the first time, and I saw Arizona and their defense, the Desert Swarm, play Penn State and LeVar Arrington. And I sat, and you played at State College.
I did.
And I was 15, and I looked around, and I was like, oh, yeah, 100,000 people, I'm playing here. And I always went and played where the biggest crowds were, where I had the most fun. And that was the day I was like, I'm going to play major college football. I didn't care. Anyway, kind of a random story, but I'm curious. Okay, so you decide you're going to go walk on. Are you preferred walk on? Are you kind of just like show up on the front door and bang down the door walk on? Where was that for you?
No, this was like a banging on the front door, the back door, the windows, climbing up the side on the gutters, like whatever it took. Mike Riley was the head coach, and he's always had an incredibly loyal, you know, amazing, thoughtful staff. And my first point of entry was the operations director at the time, Dan Vandry, who's an amazing guy, still friends to this day. And there's a funny story. I had been calling the office.
While you're in high school.
The end of high school, like the summer going in.
You know you're going there already.
I know I'm going there. I'm going to be in Corvallis regardless. But this was front and center to me, and I wanted to make this happen. So I was pulling out all the stops and doing that. So I would call the office at least once a week, probably multiple times, and then go down there. And sometimes I'd get somebody to answer the door, sometimes not. I remember one specific August afternoon, maybe late July. It was hot, you know, heat waves coming off the pavement, like fall camp hadn't started yet. I was down there for a freshman orientation, and this was kind of like, it was getting close to the do or die sort of, I'm going to, you know, be here this year or I'm not. And it was one of those fault line tipping points, like it was going to happen or it was not. And I just remember walking up the stairs to Valley Football Center. And it's one of those moments that, you know, your adrenaline gets going, like it's a biological response, and you, everything's telling you, like, you know, cower down, walk back down, like, you know, it's not for you. The easy route is back down the stairs, but you continue up them like one step at a time. And I get up to the Oregon State football office and I tell the receptionist this front, I'm here to see Dan Vandry. She's like, do you have an appointment? I'm like, no, but I need to see him anyway. And he walks out, and Dan's an amazing, amazing guy. Stands there, hears me out. I probably babbled for X number of minutes. And I stop talking, and he just looks at me, and he goes, do you know how big your pupils are right now? Which was so true, because this was a program I had grown up respecting. I had so much love for this program. I looked up to all the players. And I'm here in a spot that I feel like everybody has that I don't deserve to be here sort of feeling. And it was there in that office. It was there finally when they said, okay, we've got a couple receivers injured, like come and just run routes against our DBs. It was there. Like there was always that sort of, you know, feeling of, you know, you're not supposed to be here. You're too small, or you're too, you know, you're not strong enough, or you don't have the right skill sets, or whatever it might be. And that's, you know, I think a common thread for all walk-ons. But it is, and that's the respect that I have for you and for other people with this story, is like, it's in the face of that, that you just keep trudging up the hill. And you're just not taking no for an answer. And like, it's fun to see, you know, us now and in our creative collaborations and the other walk-ons. And of course, there are many scholarship players who have these same attributes. But I think per capita, it's more common in a walk-on to see like how that plays out later in life.
Oh, no doubt.
Crazy.
Yeah. We're going to definitely get to that. I think, you know, it's fun having this conversation with, you know, a fellow former walk-on. Because it just brings up a lot in you. I can remember going on my unofficial visit. We had a weekend off in high school football, and it was Pitt-Notre Dame, final game at Pitt Stadium. And all my whole life, I wanted to go to Notre Dame. I dreamt of it. I went to their summer camp. You know, they had one scholarship offer, and it was me or it was Ronnie Rodimer. And Ronnie Rodimer was 6'4", 215 pounds out of West Virginia, the next Randy Moss. And here I am, 5'11", 180 pounds, just fighting my ass off.
You melted the VHS tape of Rudy.
Yeah, I'm not.
It melted in the VCR.
Yeah, it did a lot. But I'm actually not a fan of Rudy for the sole reason that, like, when people compare all walk-ins to Rudy.
That's true.
It's just crap because he wasn't good. No offense, man, but like he wasn't the most athletic guy. So I always hated that comparison. But anyway, Notre Dame, Urban Meyer was the receiver coach at the time. And I get it now as being a former coach and an analyst why he chose Ronnie Rodimer over me. But I can remember being at camp. I would literally, I'd be first in line and then say, hey, Ronnie, you go first. We go to the next drill. I'd be in first. They go, Ronnie, you go first. And it was Urban Meyer and Bob Davey, and they chose him. And then I went to the Pitt-Notre Dame game, final game at Pitt Stadium, and Pitt wins. It's epic. And it's just, it's really cool. I mean, you can just imagine how beautiful it was. Anyway, the game ends. pit wins, goalposts go down, the turf gets torn up, and I sit there and I go, I'm coming here. Now, I hadn't visited the school. I didn't know anything about the academics. I mean, the complete opposite of like your world. I didn't care. I was like, I'm coming here because number one, we play Notre Dame 3 times over the next 4 years. And I'm not a huge fan of the school right now at 17 years old. I'm in. And that was the day it happened. And for the next 4 months, really nobody was down with it. You know, I was going to go to Delaware. I was committed to Princeton at one time. And all these things kind of happen. But there's this little thing inside of a walk-on that is just like, I have to try. Like, you have to go up those stairs. Mm-hmm. I would have gotten sick to my stomach if I turned on Thursday Night Football on ESPN and saw Pitt playing or another team playing, and I was playing in front of 6,000 people on Saturday. No offense to people doing that, mm-hmm. but for me, it wasn't going to be big enough, and I just had to. And nobody really, like, even my family was like, really? Like, you think you play with Antonio Bryant and some of these guys? Mm-hmm. And it was just so deep, and it's a great lesson as you talk about people who succeed past their careers walk-ons. Like, you're so connected to your feelings at such a young age of like, I have to walk up those stairs. I have to get my pupils big, and I'm going to look this dude in the eye and tell him I want it. And yeah, I'm just thinking back on it now. I had to.
Well, and there's such a, like, a gravitas, a bigness about college football for, like, you know, a 16, 17, 18-year-old male. It's like emotional. It's like bigger, it's larger than life. And I think for me, that was part of that's the reason my, you know, my pupils were the size of pennies, is like, it felt huge. It felt like a giant, you know?
Do you remember your first workout or your first practice when it was like, whoa, I'm with these guys are really good? Or was it like, yeah, I can hang?
For sure. Obviously it was on scout team, and like a lot of my game, I did well, like, you know, within 10, 15 yards of the line of scrimmage, like kind of that possession slot receiver. So I had some natural skills that I think were better than maybe people saw on the outside, of like release moves and some early stems in the routes and like some pretty good, like, you know, stop and go. And I remember the first play of practice, I lined up, and this would be a common thread between me and some of the, you know, very successful Oregon State DBs, but I lined up against Keenan Lewis, who went on to play for Pittsburgh and had an awesome career. He's a long, lanky DB, you know, really athletic. And I gave him a little shake move off the line. And that was the beginning. It was like the first one. And the ball wasn't thrown to me. It was probably, you know, thrown to the other side.
But the fellas went crazy.
But like the fellas inside my head went crazy. Mm. And it was a legitimizing moment. And soon thereafter, like, my story as a player at Oregon State, you know, was very much a utility, get in where you can fit in, utility player sort of role. And that ended up playing out on special teams in a big way. And I, you know, ended up contributing significantly on punt return and kick return. And I was a holder and did all sorts of other things. But those things came pretty soon thereafter of like doing scout team punt return. And I think Bruce Reed, the special teams coach at the time, and Coach Riley and a number of other guys are like, hey, you know, he's pretty reliable catching the ball. That's worth something, you know,
right.
Worth sticking around for the rest of the fall and maybe, you know, spring ball the next year to see what happens. And I think that's like, you know, when you're in that situation, that's the survival piece that I mentioned to start off with. It's like survival is only about the next iteration, like the next challenge, the next stepping stone. And for me, like, I've always had that, whether it's the engineering pursuit that happened in parallel, but it's like one number, one problem right after the next. And you can't look ahead farther than that.
It's so unique. I can remember I still think to this day, the best night of sleep I've ever had was the first day I got to campus at Pitt, because it was summer workout and just got destroyed. And it was me and a bunch of other scholarship freshmen, and they just, a couple of them couldn't hang. And we just got punished and punished just to, you know, the strength coaches, Buddy Morris, he's now with the Cardinals, just kind of was making an example. And you just had to do like the planks. I mean, for like 2, 3, 4 minutes at a time. I can't even imagine doing that now. But I can remember going to sleep so early that night and then getting up for throwing the next day. And I can remember the ball being so fast, like, whoa, I just ran the right route on the right timing, but the ball went right past me. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, I had to get adjusted to it. And when we got to training camp, it's one of my favorite stories of all time. I can remember walking into the locker room and looking for my locker. And I'm like, okay, I wore 30 in high school. So I just naturally went to the 30s. You know, I was like, okay, I don't see my name.
30 is a balling number for a receiver.
They didn't give me that. So then I went to the 80s. And I was like, okay, am I in the 80s? No Roth. And then I'm like, single digits, hello. So I go to the single digits and nothing there. And then I went up to this equipment manager. And whatever reason, I think equipment managers always have nicknames in college football.
They put you in the triple digits.
Dude, our equipment manager's name is Ox. And Ox is like an amazing, you know, it's like, you know, you're referencing all these old names that are just rushing through your mind. You go, hey, Ox, look at my locker. He goes, what's your name? I was like, oh, shit. Roth. And he's like, okay. And he scrolls a couple pages, goes to the very back page because that's where all the walk-ons always were. He scrolls down and goes, Roth, locker 106. And I'll never forget that to the end of time. And I was like, locker, like I played sports for a long time, bro. Like locker, jersey 106, what? And it was in the hood. I mean, it was like deep, deep in the hood of the locker room. And I walk back and my helmet had a D lineman face mask. My pads were twice the size. My cleats were size 14 and I was like 11 and a half. And it was that day I can remember looking at it and being like, okay, what are you going to do? And I was like, I'm in a relentless pursuit of a competitive edge. Like, look out. And it was like that day for me that I was like, I didn't have a sweet move at the line of scrimmage, but I was like, okay, I belong. Mm-hmm. And got lucky, played my second game as a freshman and just kind of kept fighting. But it's this fight that you get one rep a day. Like, I don't know how it was for you when you started. Like, you were on scout team. That sucks. You know, I lied my way out of scout team. Thank God.
You're smarter than I was.
Well, for whatever reason, I got lucky there. But when you got your first rep on non-scout team, describe that and what that's like. Because I think it's hard for people to understand where you get literally one rep a day.
Yeah.
And how to be sane with that.
It becomes like a cerebral experience. Like, for me, if you're in that position where it just becomes about learning the offense and winning in the spaces that you can truly win in. And for me, that was doing the things that nobody wanted to do, winning in the battles that nobody really wanted to fight in, and knowing more, or at least the pursuit of knowledge, you know, going harder at that than anybody else did. And for that first opportunity that you just mentioned of, what's the moment where it was like, you know, hey, Cav, we need you over here with number twos. Mm-hmm. It was for those reasons, you know. And I think it was probably my sophomore year, you know, that you start flexing up, guys get injured. And during the course of a long, brutal season, like, you start filling in. And and I think it was cerebral in that it just became a lot more about like running the route with, you know, the right stem, with the right half a yard difference here or there. And it's easy to sometimes overthink those things when you want it so bad. And I think a lot of walk-ons have done that, of like put themselves and work themselves in that position and then didn't stay calm. Mm-hmm. But for me, that was a thing, you know.
What was it like, rephrase, when was the first snap that you took in a real game? Who was it against? And what was the conversation like afterwards with your parents?
My dad, Dan Kavanaugh, I mean, huge influence in my life. And taught me how to be an athlete, taught me how to be a competitor. You know, I think I became a good punt returner. And he would attest to this too, because we spent hours in the backyard and he would throw a baseball as high as he could up in the air. And I'd like find a way to get under it, get my glove up and like just read the path of the ball effectively. And I honestly think that's where the punt return skill came from. Staying focused on a ball that's in the air amidst like chaos going on around you. And I think he was more blown away because he had more sort of context about what it meant to be not only on a field of competition, but just with that sort of team and group, and what sort of accomplishment that was. Because I was just kind of doing it, doing one rep at a time, one step at a time. But I think he had immense pride just me being there. I know that. And we had, you know, amazing father-son conversations. And that, you know, that was a real, you know, I think back on those and that was like really, really meaningful. And I'm proud of that, that it sparked those kind of conversations. But my first snap was my redshirt freshman year against Eastern Washington in Corvallis. And I started at punt return that game. Sammy Strotter, as you well know, would become a massive threat. And him and I, you know, started sharing punt return duties, and I'd be way back in the end zone. So, cause I never dropped the ball, and they put him out at midfield, and like, he'd, you know, take it to the hut every one of four times. But, took snaps in that game and then played a little bit at receiver that game. Actually caught a pass. My first game as a freshman.
Wow.
Caught a little flat pass from Ryan Gunderson.
We're such the same guy. I'll never forget my first snap. We're playing at Bowling Green. Okay. Now, mind you, it's week two of the season. And for those of you that haven't played college football, they put a travel roster out, right? So we're going on the road. And the sheet goes up near, like, the equipment room on, like, a Friday. And you hustle in to see it. Now, I had made the travel roster week one, which meant, like, you stay at the hotel. Week two is now a road game. And my coach comes up to me and he says, yo, I'm not sure if we're going to travel you. You know, at the time, I didn't play yet, so there's a chance to redshirt and be a scout team guy. I was there. My only goal freshman year was to not be on scout team. Because I felt if I went there, they'd bury me. And it was just an internal goal for myself. I was like, I can't go to that dark side. I'll hate my life. No way. So I go to the travel roster and he goes, yo, I don't think we're going to travel you. And I said, well, why not? He goes, well, we're probably going to play this other freshman who was my roommate, the punter at the time. He goes, and I was the backup holder. That's the only reason I traveled. And I go, coach, I respect your decision, but you know, my parents are, they're already booked their trip to Bowling Green. And he's like, really? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, all right, let me see what I could do. My parents to this day couldn't tell you where Bowling Green is. Ohio. They have zero clue what Doak Perry Stadium even means. but he got me on the travel roster. And the night before the game, as you know, you go in this hotel room, and my roommate, for whatever reason, was Antonio Bryant, who was an All-American, Biletnikoff Award winner, you know, probably most famous for throwing his jersey at Bill Parcells' face when he was drafted by the Cowboys. But he was my roommate. AB was, we called him AB, suspended for week one of the season due to, like, impermissible, I don't know what it was. He did something. All right, so here we are. And I got to remind you, Antonio Bryant is from the heartbeat of Miami, and I am from the heartbeat of Pennsylvania. A little bit different. His different city heartbeats. And my city, a little different. So we start to talk at night, just like you do. And for whatever reasons, walk-ons have like, you want to learn their story more so than maybe a scholarship guy, because you probably know the scholarship guy. Now, Antonio was the final scholarship player of his class the year prior to me getting on campus. And we talked till 3 a.m. He told me his story, how he wasn't going to be in anybody's shadow, how he was going to go off. I told him my story of how I just wanted to earn a scholarship and my dream was to play major college football. And he goes, Yogi, you're going to play tomorrow. I'm going to make it happen. So I go to bed. I'm pumped up. Well, I wake up to Bone Thugs and Harmony bumping at 6 a.m. and Antonio Bryant ironing his clothes in between Bone Thugs and Harmony, which I had never heard yet. It was gospel music that I definitely had never heard yet. And I'm sitting there in bed like, what is happening? And he's just getting his mind right for the game, just kind of dancing, swaying. Like, okay, here we go. Game starts, and he goes off. After every touchdown, he comes over to me and goes, that was for you. That was for you. That was for you. And we smoke him. It's mid-third quarter, and he's on the phone pleading with our coordinator. Put him in. You got to put him in. All of a sudden, I get a phone call. They say, Yogi, go to the phones. I run over to the phones, and I can't hear anything. And I realize that, like, my helmet's still on because the phone is going up against my helmet. Rip it off. I'm like, coach, what's up? He goes, we're going to redshirt you. You're not going to play. And I said, no problem. Can you guarantee me a scholarship? I don't know where those words came from.
You are a negotiator of all negotiators.
Middle third quarter, I'm like, you're going to guarantee? He goes, Yogi, middle third quarter. I was like, well, coach, I can only pay for 4 years of school. So you might as well play me. And he goes, fine, screw it. And they put me in the game. And in my warped brain, TK, in my warped mind, if I was like, if I get in, I'm going to play forever. Like, you can't play me week two and burn my red shirt. Like, now I'm on special teams. I'm in the rotation. Like, they would never do that. And we're on ESPN2. and they call a little bubble screen. I'm supposed to get the ball, and the quarterback audibles at the line of scrimmage, and they fumble the handoff exchange. And I still rip David Priest to this day. That should have been my first catch. But that was my first time playing. I'll never forget it. And didn't play to the last game of the year in my entire freshman year. So burned it on probably like 15 snaps, but didn't care.
That is a ballin' story.
All right. When did you, because we could go on all night about walk-on stories, but I want to know two things. One, do you agree with the statement? It's more impressive, and I don't like the word impressive, but I'm going to use it here. It's more impressive to earn a scholarship in high school or earn a scholarship in college? As a football player.
I think that both are, I mean, insanely commendable, because regardless, you are the top tier of athlete and competitor. I think it's more difficult, which may equate in this sense to impressive, to put it all on the line, to pay for your own school, to eat ramen, to, you know, in a lot of situations, not every, but do twice the work for half the amount of outcome, and invest that day after day for a long-term return, if that were to ever come. So I think to do that amidst, you know, a lot of other things going on in a, you know, 18 to 20 year old's life, to have that sort of focus is more difficult, and is something that I think I'm more proud of earning a scholarship my senior year after doing all those things and never taking a snap off, never going light in the weight room, winning every sprint and winning all those battles that, you know, I had the ability to win or wanted to win more than other people. I think I'm more proud of that than I would have been taking a scholarship to a smaller school out of high school, you know, or even being a different player and getting that. And that's not to say that it's not a massive monumental accomplishment to be a decorated, you know, student athlete in high school enough to garner interest at whatever level and get a scholarship.
Right.
But for me, I attribute, you know, I mentioned this before, I attribute so much of my mentality and mindset, and probably in some ways the vices and the virtues, the stubbornness I have now that I think in some ways equates to good things happening in my life, to that sort of investment. Because for the first, you know, 4 years while I was on campus in Corvallis, my mindset every day was, you know what, I'm putting in the work, the 5 a.m., the midnight studying, like all this stuff, for a payoff that I'm hoping or I'm anticipating is going to come later. And that's like, I mean, that's huge. Like, you're a parent, right? You want to teach your kid delayed gratification, you know, working for something, developing something so it pays later. That's hard. But that, I think, for me was really refined. And that was a galvanizing sort of, you know, thing for me. So I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, you should be. I think it's totally way more impressive to get a scholarship in college.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, every school is full of whatever, 25 kids per year that get it out of high school and they've earned it. They're ballers. But what blew my mind, I wasn't ready for this coming into college, was the coaches, they don't play guys that they like. They play who they trust. And that to me was like a huge deal of like, this guy is 6'3", runs like the wind, but can't catch, you know, or doesn't go to class, and they just can't trust him on third down. And I think for you and I, as our careers went, all of a sudden we were playing on third down. You know, maybe we weren't on first and second down, or we were both the safe punt returners, you know, like when it really mattered, it came down to trust.
Yeah.
And I think even in our careers now, like, we want to work with people that we trust. Like, I trust you, like nobody I've ever trusted creatively. He's got it. I don't have to double check that. And I think vice versa. But before we go on to the post-career stuff, because we'll get there, I want to know, I got two questions for you. One, what was the day like when you got a scholarship? paint that picture for us.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say that it was as dramatic as a lot of the, you know, walk-on videos coming out of all the programs nowadays, which I think are amazing and emotional and, like, you know, I feel like I know every guy in that video, you know, where the coach walks in, supposed to be some jersey reveal, and it's actually, like, you know, whoever is, you know, getting a scholarship after 3-4 years. And everybody knows that guy. And everybody appreciates that guy's commitment to the program for giving so much for so little in return. But those, that's like, you know, that's the glue of any organization. Like, you know, and we're going to get into the future stuff, but it just, that's so huge. So the day for me was very unlike that. It was very just kind of, it was honestly basic.
And what year is this?
This was my senior fall camp.
Okay.
Early in fall camp, my senior year. And I think, you know, we've traded stories here and there. I never asked or said one thing about a scholarship ever. You know, in my meetings with Coach Riley once a year to other guys, like, most of my outlook was just like, I didn't, especially early, didn't need to say much. It was just like what I was doing that was going to speak for itself. And I really live by that, maybe even to a fault. So I had not mentioned one thing leading up to this. It was the first daily double, and it was the evening practice in Reser Stadium. And Coach Losey, Jay Losey, the receivers coach at the time, who I had a connection with for sure, came up to me while we were warming up, and I'm out there catching 50 punts before practice or whatever. And he just comes up to me and he's like, I just had a meeting just before practice with Coach Riley, and some things have shifted around, and I can honestly say that it's a huge privilege, and I'm really proud to say that we're going to put you on scholarship for the rest of your time here at Oregon State. And I think I gave him a big hug, said, I appreciate this more than anything, but I got to go catch this next punt. And it was something like that. And then I went back to the dorm later that evening, and I called my dad first thing and said, Dad, guess what? This is what Coach Losey just told me. And I mean, it was really fulfilling, you know, to have that finally, that investment to finally come to fruition.
When you get put on scholarship, you get like life kind of changes a little bit. Like, was that for you? And not like, okay, your celebrity life, but like you eat different. Get a little change in your pocket. Like, what was that like for you when you didn't have that? You know, when you looked at scholarship players that you were playing ahead of, that, you know, you don't go to training table. Like, mm-hmm. You got to eat the ramen. You know, you don't get $800 or whatever it was for you a month. Like, you got to work a couple jobs. You know, did you feel frustration? Like, you said you didn't say much, but you're a pretty expressive, creative guy. Like, I wondered what was the inner dialogue like for you then? And were you pissed you weren't on? I mean, you played as a redshirt freshman. You got to wait 4 years. I'd be pissed, personally.
Yeah. I think it was just for me, I think that it's just all response, you know. And I have really lived and died by that. Of like, how are you going to use it for motivation? And for me, there was kind of a F it sort of attitude. And my sort of action from that was not, you know, acting out or going a different direction. It was just like, I'm going to grind even harder. Like, the best way for me to say, you know, this is what I'm worth and this is what I deserve is just to leave no doubt. Just to be, you know, my brother and I, my younger brother Connor, who was an even better athlete than I was, played at Portland State. Used to have this saying between us, like through high school and in college, be so good they can't ignore you. Yeah. Like, just, that's like sticking it to the man, right? Of like being so good and working so hard that it's just, you can't, whether other people are going to do the speaking for you, your actions, like, so that was really my response, you know? And there were certainly moments of frustration. Like, I can remember one visceral example in particular of like, there was a time that the NCAA allowed walk-ons to pay for training table meals, which I took advantage of. And then NCAA rules, as they commonly do, shifted, and I couldn't pay to go up and eat the food anymore. And it was kind of this, like, you know, meeting in the operations director's office. And, like, that was the first time I walked out of there and I was like, damn, I feel down right now. Like, maybe it's too much. You know, maybe it's a little too much. So for me, it was always the response of, like, kicking back of, like, you know what? That's going to make me run routes even harder against Keenan Lewis. Like, I'm sorry, Lulu. Like, you can get pissed at me every day or whoever that was. But that was sort of my sort of aggressive response and outlet.
Yeah. I can remember my first aggressive response was like first week of practice. You know, I was playing scout team DB in training camp, like with the receivers. You know, like, okay, we're going to show you cover two shell on a three deep or whatever. Strong safety, roll up. And I was going for it. And I remember one of the receivers, RJ English, like, he's like, yo, dude, what are you doing? And I took a swing at him. And we kind of got into it. And I was like, it was like that moment where, like, life paused. And I was either going to, like, wear it and play, like, 70%. Or I was like, no, dude, like, this is the only snap of my life I'm going to play scout team DB. So I'm going to light you up. And I'll never forget it. But, you know, you talk about your scholarship moment. It's interesting. I can remember calling my dad as well. And I was different than you. Like, you have way more patience than I do, which is a great skill, which is why you're such a gifted, beautiful director of so many stories. I went in from freshman year on and met twice a year with the head coach. And I was like, coach, he knew it was coming. I think I deserve scholarship. And he'd say, Yogi, you don't. And I'd say, all right, what do I need to do? And I'd make him spell it out for me. Sophomore year, I start a bunch of games. I think I deserve a scholarship. You did a nice job, but you still got to earn it. Okay, what do I need to do? And I was just, okay, you need to beat this consistent DB every day. I'd line up every day against them. And I was literally making my own cut-ups to basically just prove my case of, like, okay, maybe I didn't run a 4.440, but my route, when I run an out route, I'm two steps ahead of the guy who does because I'm that efficient with my footwork. And just, you start to plot out how you're going to do it. And I can remember I got to my junior year, which is when I got the scholarship. I walked up into the coach's office and, you know, all the receivers are like ears against the door. And he tells me it. And now, like, I'm kind of like I'm excited about it, of course. But I'm, in my eyes, like, I'd been told no so many times that it didn't matter. Like, it was, I went from locker 106. My teammates basically put me over in locker 82 because I was wearing the jersey 82, and I took my nameplate. I'll never forget. I took the locker 106 nameplate and put it up at 82. I was like, I'm going to keep my homies, like, with me. And so in my eyes, like, the scholarship meant nothing outside of my parents didn't have to pay for school anymore. And I can remember calling home, and that was the coolest part. Mm-hmm. And it was great, you know. I just went right back to work. And But calling my dad to this day, I was in Squirrel Hill walking up this, like, long hill. And I was like, yo, man, I got a scholarship today. And it was cool. It was a memory that I think I'll remember my whole life. But I do remember not being defined that day as a scholarship player. Because in my eyes, I was like, I already am, man. Like, I'm already playing.
Yeah. I did, as I commonly do, I used to do, like, kind of audio journals, video journal stuff.
Of course you did.
And I'll have to pull it up. So I haven't listened to it since that day, you know, August of college. But I did, like, a 10-minute video journal.
What?
That, like, after I got off the phone with my dad. Just, like, and I don't remember what I said, you know, just kind of documenting the emotion of the moment. Someday we'll pull that out of the archives.
Yes. Okay, so another walk-on question for you before we kind of spin it to the future. I'm curious, what's the craziest thing or the most outside the box? Like, what's the thing that, you know, is just a gnarly story about how you created your edge? Like, I think walk-ons we're always doing something extra. Like, what was it for you? Was it, like, crazy film study? Was it Sunday workouts? Like, what, how did you, and maybe it's not something gnarly, but how did you create your edge? So at least you walked onto the field smaller than everybody, maybe a little slower, but, like, confident, at least internally, as a quiet guy, as you referenced, saying, okay, here we go. I'm going to go line up against you again.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were two things come to mind. And they were more kind of in the training, three things actually. Kind of the edge creation, if you will. One is I became like one of the strongest guys for kind of my size and weight, just outworking in the weight room. And that was a huge asset to me because I could hang on the line of scrimmage with other strong DBs and use my, you know, use my quickness along with, you know, some really good built upper body strength to have those sort of hand battles at the line. So technically, I think that was one. Two is in training, like on the field ever, I never allowed any body language to like come out that I was tired ever. So I never put my hands on my hips. I never put my hands on my head. I never, like a lot of guys, we'd finish sprints and like you just collapse to the ground. As much as it took, I never did that.
Totally, man. That was your win. It
was a minor thing at the time, but it was a major sort of result in the eyes of others. And I think I told you this, like another thing that I'm proud of when I think back, and I don't commonly think back to these days, which is why this is fun. But Coach Riley and the staff gave out an award every year, you know, for most improved, or, you know, I don't know if they gave out an MVP or whatnot, but they gave out this award called the Lunch Bucket Award, which is like the dude that brings the lunch bucket every day, you know, puts on the hard hat and just goes to work, essentially like, you know, the hardest worker on the team. And I won it 4 years. And I think it was largely for that reason, because it wasn't just the mental toughness to finish every rep and finish every sprint, but don't show anybody else you're tired. Mm-hmm. And that's a major, it's kind of like a poker face. Like nobody knows what's going on inside if you can withhold that communication. And in terms of how that eventually played out, like on scout team and competition between players, because competition on a football team is a very healthy thing. You're always competing. Training anytime, you're always competing. That was huge. The last thing, another small thing, during the game or practice, I never took my helmet off.
Same here.
Never did it. Same. See, that's wild. We haven't talked about that. That's awesome. Never took it off. Yep. Ever.
Yeah.
I took it off when I got in the locker room, but that was it. And it's kind of like almost like, you know, if you're a police officer, like you wouldn't want to take off your Kevlar vest. Like before you got back into like, you know, your locker back at the precinct, like you're not going to like take it off early before you get back on your run or your shift. I kind of thought about it the same way, you know, and it's kind of like a mask. Like nobody can really see what you're thinking. Kind of that same thing of like, you're not really giving away showing you're tired or, you know, you're hurting or whatever. Like it's just kind of it's like the first most prominent piece of armor on the football field, you know?
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Totally align with that. I can remember where my edge, I felt I was creating it. You know, I always believed in, and I'm not really a great fan of this quote anymore, but it was, I grew up with it on my wall. Like when you're not working, someone somewhere, when the two of you meet, given fairly equal ability, he will win, right? Bill Bradley. And I think it gives too much credit to like your opponent now as like an adult, but back then you better believe I believed in that. Mm-hmm. And when I was a walk-on, I was working two jobs, and I think both of us took full advantage of being a student athlete. You know, I was interning at a state rep's office and the mayor's office, and then at night I'd be a bouncer, which might be hard to believe for some of you, but I was a badass bouncer at High Tops downtown mm-hmm. Pittsburgh. But on the way home from High Tops on the weekends, I always had sneaks in my car, and you know, I didn't really party that much, so you know, I wasn't like ripping to the next party. And I'd always drive by Duquesne University, and Duquesne University had an intramural field. And so you finish like as a bouncer, cleaning up, taking the trash out, whatever. It's probably like 3 a.m. and like 3:30, this intramural field was just lit with like the parking lot lights, and it was like perfect, right? Like I felt like I was kind of back in the sticks in northeastern Pennsylvania. And I go run routes. No ball, but I just imagine. And visualization has been a huge part of my life. Didn't realize it. Didn't realize that was the phrase.
I can say the same.
But I was doing it in high school. I'd visualize so much. I never visualized the second half because I was like, I'm on the bench. I just scored 6 touchdowns. Right. And I would go through every single game and I would play it. And then I'd catch the game winner. The last 12 routes would be the game winner. And I was calling it as a broadcaster. Roth split out to the left in motion in the slot. It's a corner route, ball on the money, catches it down the sideline. He goes, touchdown, Panthers beat Penn State. Like, I would literally be saying it like a maniac in the middle of the morning in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But that's where I cultivated my edge. And nobody, like, this is the first time I've ever shared it. But it was just that thing where I was like, I think if you're a walk-on, a scholarship player, a CEO, you know, a scrub, like, you've got to find your edge and you got to believe that you created it. And that was it, man. And I'd come up and then I'd go work out Sundays and the players were there and they knew some of the extra stuff, but nobody ever knew Saturday and Friday nights at 3-4 in the morning. And that was kind of like, that was like my armor too of like, you don't even know, bro. Yeah. Like, just put me in the game.
Yeah. Because, you know, I'm sure you'll attest to this too. Like, most people don't know this, like fans in any program look outside looking in. The turnover in a program is immense between personnel and players. And like you have an entity of say 200 people, including support staff and players and everything. A lot of people come and go. And walk-ons for sure come and go. You know, your preferred walk-on and then you get injured and you're out. Like, there's no room for any sort of like failure. So the turnover, so as hard as it is to make the team, being reliable and consistent and staying on the team is the next hardest thing, if not harder than the first step, you know? So those edges are huge.
Well, and even like to me, the receiver is interesting because, you know, this like every spring you'd lose receivers, then you'd be the dude in spring ball. And then they bring in a fresh crop of wideouts. And the receiver is like the easiest position to play as a true freshman. So, like, I can remember Larry Fitzgerald came in. I thought I was starting on the video game. I was starting in life in spring ball. Like, I was going to be the dude. And all of a sudden, junior year, like, who is this dude from Minnesota? And he happens to be the third pick or whatever it was in the NFL draft a couple years later. And, you know, it's that position that you just got to keep fighting for, and it comes down to trust. So, anyway, all right. So, I want to keep moving on. We said we'd do this for 20 minutes, and we're definitely more than double that. But where do you think now, you know, and I talked about in the open about your production company, Blue Ox, you guys do so much cool work. You just did the beautiful, multitude of pieces with Kevin Hart, with Nike. You were directing, producing cinematography on The Drive, the documentary series that I get to narrate on the Pac-12 Network. You and your partner, Matt Wilcox, and, you know, it's led by Mike Talajan at the Pac-12. Where does being a walk-on keep showing up for you? And are you aware of it, or is it just embedded in you?
I think it shows up in two like very distinct pursuits in my life right now. And of course it's kind of woven into others, but these are the most visible sort of visceral examples. One is a professional thing and one's a personal thing. Professionally, it is starting a business, being an entrepreneur. And I say that relation is so one for one, apples to apples, because as a walk-on going through the course of 4 years, you are feeling immense up and downs in the course of a practice, in the course of a workout, in the course of a season, a week, a month, a year, a career. It's crazy ebbs and flows. Like, you can be feeling like, you know, I caught 8 passes in my first spring game for like 100 yards. That's like twice the amount as anybody else. Huge high. Like, and then you just get your ass kicked in a workout and like, you know, you're back down, you know, to that level. So the exact same emotions are inherent in building a business. At least they have been for me in the 3 or 4 that I've been a part of. And it's just every day, like, you get a new client and then you bomb a project, you don't perform, and you're up and you're down. And just that ability to keep your helmet on and like not showing the emotion and just sticking, like flatlining with a slight upward trend over time, is like, that's it. And it takes that same sort of emotional control, like day after day, to do that and just keep on putting your foot in, you know, and like keep on making calls and keep on reaching out and keep on coming to the table with your best creative effort as a filmmaker or director or whatever your business of choice is. And doing that every day is so difficult. It really is for any entrepreneur, for any athlete, like being reliable every day, showing up is like, that is hard to do, you know? So it certainly plays out in that. And I feel like I'm continually sharpened and inspired and just kind of innately have some of that, but it's a muscle, right? Like you and I both know most of our muscle mass from our playing days is gone now physically. The brain's the same way. Like you got to continually build that. You got to continually build that up. You can build on past work and success and, you know, callousness and muscle mass, but like you got to keep on doing it. So I think the foundation is there from that. The second one is a more personal, fun sort of enjoyment activity. I relate being a walk-on and going through a program the same as a hobby I have of climbing a mountain. And it's kind of an analogy that kind of makes sense, but alpine climbing, my wife and I, a couple buddies and I like to do it. And you're climbing, you know, a 12,000 foot mountain. And there's one feeling, Yogi, that feels the same as that anxiety, that nervous kind of anxious excitedness you have rolling up to a bus when like there's fans on the side starting to shake the bus and you start to see the stadium and like the lines are already down, the pylons are in place, and like you're, you know, 2 hours and a couple of taped ankles away from like going out and performing. It's rolling up on Mount Rainier or Mount Hood or something, and you look up and it's like, that thing can probably kill me. And it's dark, it's midnight, and you're like, I got a headlamp and one other person and some boots on, and I'm going to climb all the way up to the top and be there on sunrise. And that sort of feeling is the same, is the only thing that's really, even creating a business and all that, is really gets that like emotional, primal like thing going, you know? And the last thing that I'll say about sort of that personal pursuit that's similar to me is it's just one step at a time. It's crazy when you're climbing a mountain or even hiking or doing anything like that. It feels like so tedious, like you're one step at a time, one after the next, thousands of iterations. But like you finally get to a spot and you don't really know how far you've gone because you've just been trudging like one after the next, and you like turn around and you can see like, you can see the ocean from like 100 miles away because you've gotten up higher than you thought you could. And to me, that's like a very relatable thing that I felt down at Oregon State of like, it's every day, it's every route, it's every lift, it's every rep, it's every sprint, you know? And then that moment where you kind of turn around or peek over your shoulder for the first time of like, you know what? Other people were looking, I've got a great view now, and I've got a scholarship and some books and school paid for too.
Before we let you go, there's a walk-on listening to this right now, and it's late at night, and they just went from second team to fourth team, and their reps got cut dramatically, money's tight, their friends are bringing them training table, and they're thinking about transferring. What are you going to tell them?
I would say the same thing that I commonly told myself. Even though it may seem like it, hard work is never wasted. It's not a zero-sum thing. Like, whether it pays off immediately, short-term, mid-term, long-term, like, the aggressive pursuit of excellence and just hard work is never, it's never wasted. You're just saving it up, you're putting it in the bank for something else. Mm. The second thing I would say right alongside that is, it's easy in a collegiate program, even as walk-ons, to live in your own bubble. Like, I want this. We're talking about it. Like, we're talking about our own personal experiences. At the same time, the most authentic pursuit is doing it because we are humans and we're somewhat innately selfish, and that's okay to a certain extent. But doing it because you want to create a better culture at the program. It's never a perfect situation to buy all the way into that, but having that sort of mentality and allowing that to drive you at least a little bit will put you in a place, along with the first thing I said, to be able to choose your response.
Yeah.
Choose your response to be saying no to training table, to getting put down on the depth chart, and like building a business, climbing a mountain, running a podcast, creating content. Response is everything.
That's a cool phrase. Choose your response. Cause that's what you control, right? As cliche as that is, like, you know, since I was a kid, I had a piece of paper that is still in my bedroom, I think in Pennsylvania. It's torn now. And it says, hard work always pays off, and always is like underlined, italics, bold, and good things always happen to good people. And I can remember telling that to some of my scholarship receiver teammates, and the ones that lasted, they said that was the one thing they took away most. And I think I always equated that to touchdowns. I always equated that to, you know, a scholarship, to something tangible. And now, being older and not having played, unfortunately, for a while, even though we both want to right now, I realized that, you know, the hard work does pay off. It may not pay off like we dreamt of in our tiny towns when we wanted to play at Research Stadium or play at Heinz Field, but it pays off in a lot of different ways. And I was that walk-on. You were that walk-on late at night. You know, you weren't crying. It was just dusty in your room, and you're just dealing with that. But you literally, I would say, dive in even harder. Love your sport even harder. And meet even more people. Leverage the daylights out of being a major, big-time collegiate student athlete. And because it does pay. It does pay off. You know, it does. And you're a perfect example of it with where you are in your career now. Okay, so before I let you go, on this podcast, we've added a couple extra questions at the end. And the first one is, now, as a beautifully told story of your walk-on path, and there's so many more layers to it we didn't even touch, and now as a successful, you know, business owner and storyteller, what is it in life that you seek?
I think there's a pause here because I think it's a meaningful place to like really think out that question. It's a really good one. You know, the best quote about your pursuit in life that I've ever read is in Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And he says, the meaning of life, and this is a guy who lived through a hellish environment, crazy time in history. He said, the meaning of life is to help others find the meaning of theirs.
Mm.
And there is no truer statement than that, right? Like it checks all the boxes. It's selfless. Like it's all these things. And for me, it is like an ultimate truth. And I think in a small way, it's that, if that's the nucleus, like it's, you know, that sphere that I'm seeking to tell a story or do something that is going to enable somebody else to find what they're seeking or their why. And, you know, I think that's the ultimate picture and the ultimate goal. Mm. And there's, of course, like building blocks that you have to do to support that, making a living, building a business, maintaining relationships, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those are important in their own right. But I think in the end of the day, I think that might be the ultimate judgment, you know? So seeking that, I think, through enlightening yourself, enlightening others, teaching others. And I think it goes to your last point, which about being a walk-on, that really resounded with me, is if I were to say one last thing to some other walk-on in that sort of situation, it would be at biologically at that time, like at 18, 19, 20 years old, like you're not capable of understanding like the whole world around you and like the impact, like scientifically, you're not biologically able to, like your brain hasn't developed yet. But you just never know who's watching, who's around you. Like the guy that could be the scrub, that's even more of a scrub than you, could end up being some crazy business owner or some uber success. It could be your business partner. Like you never know, you know, you never, ever know. which I think relates to that, my final statement there of like, you gotta help other dudes do their thing too. And like, I still go back, like Jay Losey is coaching at Lewis and Clark back in Portland now. And like, I'm proud of a lot of the stuff I did, you know, and he'd validate a lot of this stuff, but every time I see him, he's still like, you know what, Cav, you know, the biggest contribution you had is that you made it possible when James Rogers showed up on campus, he was ready to play as early as he was because you helped him learn the offense. And like, he did the same thing for Brandon Cooks, and who knows what sort of chain would or would not have been possible without that. And I think in the end of the day, that'll be maybe one of the things I'm most proud of, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I just think back to when Larry showed up. It was the same deal. He's your roommate. Teach him the offense. Mm-hmm. You mean you want him to take my job? Teach him the offense. And that allowed us to win more games, you know? Okay, as we always end this podcast, because you've listened to it, I think we all know the answer to this, but how do you feel about the word limits?
You have to define that word for me. I don't know. It's not registering in my head.
For walk-ins, it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't. That's okay.
They're meant to be just like rules. Learn them so you know how to break them.
Learn them so you know how to break them. That was just classic. That was a really fun conversation for me, and especially now, amid college football. I think we're all kind of glued to it to a certain degree, or at least a lot of the people that are listening to this. And we're amid a time with the greatest walk-on, I'd argue, in the history of the game in Baker Mayfield. I mean, he walked on to two universities and won the Heisman Trophy. I just had a chance to spend time with Baker Mayfield. You can check it out on my Facebook page at the Heisman Trophy with the Pac-12 Networks, and got to interview him one-on-one. And I remember when he was in high school, and nobody really knew him. He reminded me of that when he was at the Elite 11 camp. But you have to have something a little different. You got to have a deep belief in yourself, and you got to find ways to seek your edge. Taylor clearly did that. He never put his hands on his hips. You know, my edge was, you know, I never was going to bend over. I never really drank a lot of water. I was just going to find some little edge where it worked in my mind. And I think if I was going to sum it up, you try to find this way to live on the razor's edge. So I hope you enjoyed that one. I hope you look at yourself in your life, in your walk on, quote unquote, journey as you dive into that sojourn, and just chase it relentlessly, because nobody's necessarily going to give you the keys to that car. So appreciate the time. And as we always end these podcasts the same way, that the only limits that we have in life are the ones we set ourselves. Keep seeking. Peace.